avoiding the problem, but doing so in ways that actually might make our lives better.
Our guest, Professor Susan Clayton, is author of many papers, books, and reports on climate anxiety. When not at the College of Worcester in Ohio, Susan is in Paris at the Institute for Advanced Studies. Find links to the papers and reports we talked about in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Susan, you are so busy. Thank you for taking time to spend with our listeners.
Well, thanks for calling attention to this topic.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
American weather has become one long accident this winter. In the United States, the January 2023 temperature was 5.1 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than average, the sixth warmest January on record. That is according to the U.S. government agency NOAA. Most states in New England set an absolute record for January heat this year, with second warmest for New York and Pennsylvania state. On Thursday, February 23, thermometers went over 70 degrees Fahrenheit in Islip, New York, and Bedford, Massachusetts. That's over 21 degrees C. Crazy summertime weather in winter. Strange, isn't it? Of course, weather whiplash may still set in. High above us, even higher than the Chinese spy balloon, a relatively rare sudden stratospheric warming event has already begun. This could distort the polar vortex below, tossing frigid weather back across the continent for a few days at least. Maybe that will hit Eastern Europe as well. The rest of this winter is, as they say, still up in the air. Do you like vegetables, fruits, and nuts? They are the healthy foods. On this planet, they all depend on other animals, from bugs to bats to fertilized flowers that become our food. As you know, pollinators are in trouble. Humans change the landscape, apply pesticides, and heat up the climate. Are we headed into a pollinator crisis? Dr. Matthew R. Smith is a research scientist at the Harvard Chan School of Public Health in Boston. In earlier work, he asked, what happens if we lose the pollinators? Now Matthew leads a team adding up the consequences for food and human health as pollinators decline, and that cost is high already in money and lives lost. Matthew Smith, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
The opening of your study might confuse some of our listeners. When experts talk about pollinator animals, we might picture wildlife brushing up against plants or something. What is included in pollinator animals?
Sure, yeah. Animal pollinators is a broad term. Most of the time we're talking about insects. So this is both bees that you might expect to be big pollinators, honeybees, bumblebees, solitary bees, but also a range of other insects like flies, moths, butterflies, beetles, wasps, all of these play a role in pollinating flowers. And then to a much less extent, but some specific in some areas, are mammals or birds that might also visit flowers, but those are relatively minor players.
Yeah, bats are part of the team.
Yes, bats are also part of the team.
So we need one more term here before we get rolling. You say food pollinated by insects, quote, helps protect against non-communicable disease. What is that, and how do non-communicable diseases compare to something that we're all familiar with, like COVID-19, when it comes to premature deaths or disability?
Sure. Well, non-communicable diseases are a very broad term, just capturing everything that is a disease that is not really infectious or communicable between people. So these are things that are major health risks around the world, like heart disease, cancer, strokes, diabetes. These are all types of non-communicable disease that are just major killers. COVID-19 is a communicable disease. It's an infectious disease.
So parents are famous for saying, eat your vegetables. How can veggies, fruits, and nuts help us live longer and better?
Sure. So this is a pretty well-established finding that if that, well, okay, let me start over. So this is, it's pretty well established based on a range of epidemiological studies where they've watched people while they've eaten a range of different amounts of fruits and vegetables and nuts, and they have found that in study after study that eating more fruits, more vegetables, more nuts protects against both contracting and dying from these major non-communicable diseases. So you see lower rates of heart disease, stroke, cancers, diabetes from eating more of these foods. And so, it's just, it shows that they have a protective effect when eaten in higher amounts.
There's a bit of a puzzle in your results. Your study found the impacts of a pollinator shortage were, quote, greater in middle and high-income countries with higher rates of non-communicable disease, end quote. And yet the World Health Organization says of all the NCD deaths, 77% are in low- and middle-income countries. Why are high-income countries more at risk from diet-related disease?
What we found in our study was that if pollinators were more abundant, then we had the potential to produce a considerably higher amount of these healthy foods. And what happens next is that when these foods are produced in higher amounts, the price might drop of those foods. And there's this whole global economic system that kicks in that redistributes those foods around the world. And so different countries have different abilities to pay for those foods. There's all these different responses based on how willing you might be to buy more of that food if the price drops by a certain amount. And so what we found was that a lot of those foods would end up flowing to countries that could afford them. And so those tended to be middle-income countries, high-income countries. And so those, when those countries, I guess also those countries tended to have higher rates of non-communicable disease at the same time. And so you had this combination of more food flowing to these higher-income countries, kind of middle and higher-income countries, and that protective effect having a bigger impact because of that rates of non-communicable disease.
A study published October 2022 in Nature finds 65% of all insect populations they examined could go extinct this century. Does that apply to the pollinators? What do you think?
Yes, as insects are going extinct, pollinators are definitely going to go extinct as well. They are suffering from the same stressors that all other insects are. So you're seeing major land use change that's removing their habitat, also fragmenting their habitat so that they can't migrate to adapt from different stressors. You have climate change that's changing their suitable range where they used to live, so they have to migrate. They're also being infiltrated by new insects that are coming into their range because of climate change. There's new pathogens that are preying on them. There's an asynchrony between when a kind of a timing mismatch that may be occurring between when pollinators might emerge from the ground in the spring and when the plants that they rely on are emerging because of different environmental cues getting disrupted because of climate change. And also liberal use of pesticides, especially this particularly toxic class of pesticides called neonicotinoids that have well-known lethal and sublethal effects on bees that are being used. And these are the most common class of pesticides in the U.S. They've been banned in the EU, but they're very common in the rest of the world. So all of these stressors are affecting bees, they're affecting other insects, and so they're definitely at risk of both extinction, but also, you know, just general declines in abundance and range.
Now, your study goes beyond health to look at the economic impacts, and there's a lot between the farmer and the consumer. There's a whole industry going on there, transportation, storage, sales, supermarkets, all of that. But my question is, how can anyone know what large-scale agricultural production would have been if a full roster of pollinators were there?
So what we had was really a combination of two pieces of information that helped us understand that. One is a model that really tried to capture, based on what people are growing now in every country of all of these different pollinated foods, how much could they theoretically grow if everything were perfect? And this is not just related to pollination, but it's also if they were applying fertilizers and using improved seed and using kind of industrial agricultural techniques, how much could they theoretically grow? And to understand that, they looked at yields all over the world and said, well, based on the climate constraints in your country, here's what other countries around the world are growing of similar crops. And based on your climate constraints, here's what kind of the 90th percentile yield of that certain crops is. So that gives you an idea of the difference between what you're currently growing and what you could conceivably grow. And then to understand what the percentage of that gap comes from just inadequate pollination, here we relied on a lot of empirical data where one of our colleagues, Lucas Garibaldi, led the study a few years ago where he and his team collected a ton of data from 344 different farms around the world on four different continents, growing all kinds of crops under all kinds of different management conditions. And what they were able to do was, while looking at these farms, also look at what pollinators were visiting these farms and how often and what the diversity of pollinators was. And they could isolate the importance of having more and having diverse pollinators to yields across all these different crops and across all these different geographies. And so controlling for all those other factors, what role does pollination play in suppressing yields below what they could currently grow? So,
and we all talk about the bees. I just want to put in a word for the moths. As a gardener, I know moths are always busy in my vegetable beds. Can farms push production with chemical fertilizers to the point where a drop in pollination can be overcome?
There are certainly ways that you can increase yields sort of via conventional agricultural techniques, like using fertilizers, like using improved seeds, like using pesticides to keep crop damage down. The trouble is that these often have kind of collateral environmental impacts. So you can pollute waterways, you can contaminate the soil, you can have, and especially in the case of pesticides, you can have sort of collateral damage on the insects that you need to pollinate your crops. The benefit of supporting pollinators as opposed to pursuing these other techniques is that pollinators have no environmental harms. They are part of nature, and so they are going to improve crop yields relatively cheaply and without this kind of collateral damage that you might inflict from using more intense techniques.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Matthew R. Smith with a new paper adding up the costs for all of us as food pollinators decline around the world. Matt, what does your new study say for the global estimated loss of fruit, vegetables, and nuts due to pollinator decline alone?
What we did in our study was quantify the reduction in production that we're suffering from having too little pollinators. And what we found was that between 3 and 5% of the production of these different foods, of fruits, nuts, and vegetables, is missing due to insufficient pollination.
Why do statistics show North America has about 12% more fruit, veggies, and nuts than would be expected if there were enough pollinators?
So yes, in North America, if globally there was more pollination and there was an increase in global food production, a lot of foods would become cheaper to produce. And so a lot of these higher value foods like fruits and vegetables and nuts would likely become grown in lower and lower middle income countries. And higher income countries would just import that food. It would be cheaper for them to just import that food than it would be to grow it themselves.
And I was surprised to see Russia near the top of the list for, quote, current life years lost attributable to insufficient pollination. I guess it's too much to ask of one study why that is, but it is surprising, isn't it?
We found a similar result in an earlier paper that you mentioned in the introduction, where we ran kind of a hypothetical study where we said, what if there were zero pollinators around the world? And what would that do for production of these healthy foods. And that was clearly an extreme case, not a very likely case at all, but it was meant to just kind of quantify the net benefit of having pollinators. And we found a similar effect that Russia had a fairly high rate of disease that was, I guess, attributable to either losing pollinators or not having enough pollinators. And I think that's really a result of two things. One is that rates of these chronic diseases are fairly high in Russia, so eating more of these foods would confer a considerable benefit to public health. And also that they are at the cusp of income where if prices did change a little bit, that the change in the food that is flowing to Russia might change quite a bit. And so the combination of those two factors really contributes to them being either beneficiary of having more pollination or victim of having too little pollination, I guess, depending on how you frame it.
And it's not one size fits all the world over, because you found some regions like Australia, quote, would have seen relatively little difference in mortality under higher pollination scenarios compared with the present day. So it's not just one way all around the world. Some places seem to be still getting away with it.
Yes. For some countries, either they would not change their diets very much if food production changed, or they are already eating quite a bit of some of these foods, and so relatively small changes in the diet would not confer a big health benefit. So either one of those factors could affect who might see a large change if there were more pollination.
Why did your team choose Nepal, Honduras, and Nigeria for more detailed case studies?
Well, we really just wanted to choose countries that were fairly different from each other. I guess all low and lower middle income countries, but very different geographies, very different agricultural systems, very different sizes of country, to capture how each of these factors might affect how these countries would respond to higher pollination. And for these countries in particular, as you mentioned, we found that the health benefits of having more pollination were concentrated in middle-income countries, higher-income countries. But for the lower and lower middle-income countries, you saw a much larger economic effect from having more pollination. And we found between 12 and 31% of agricultural value, so the economic value that's gained from growing these foods, is lost because of having too little pollination. And in these countries where agriculture makes up a large percentage of the total economy, that would have a huge effect on both the income of farmers and the larger agricultural industry. And that might also have trickle-down effects to their health, as they're able to afford health care and they're able to just engage in practices that would improve their health. But yeah, those were the three case studies we looked at for just looking at this economic effect.
From what we know so far, do you think pollinator populations are at a crisis point or heading there?
They are certainly heading there. It's very difficult to know the state of pollinators because it is very intensive, labor intensive to run a study where you are monitoring pollinators over large areas. So there are studies here and there that have monitored populations, but we don't know the full global picture. So it's very difficult to understand whether we are at a crisis or we are merely in trouble. But we are certainly trending towards a crisis with all of the different stressors that are affecting pollinators. There has to be major concerted effort at a scale that matches the rate of change of these populations that would offset these stressors that are affecting them. So, yes, we're certainly trending in a dangerous direction, but it's difficult to know whether we are at the brink or not.
Well, I want to get more into solutions in just a minute. But first, as you mentioned, in 2015, you led a paper in the top medical journal, Lancet. Your team analyzed what would happen if we lose half or even all animal pollinators. Matt, what does happen if the bees, bats, and moths disappear?
that was an extreme case. we were not quite predicting that all pollinators would disappear, but what it did capture was the extreme case of no pollinators and how, by doing that, it quantifies their contribution to our food production and our health. And so what we found in that study was that if there was a full loss of pollinators, that you would see a reduction in global fruit, vegetables, and nuts and seeds between 16 and 23% of production. And that would cause something like 1.4 million additional deaths a year via predominantly the rise in non-communicable disease. We also looked at how micronutrient deficiencies might change, because not only do these foods protect against chronic disease, but they're also suppliers of important nutrients to the diet, like vitamin A, folate. And what we found was by far the bigger effect comes from by rises in chronic disease, but there is, especially in areas that are suffering from higher rates of malnutrition-related disease, such as sub-Saharan Africa and parts of South America, that you would see a rise in disease there. But most of the effect was from rises in non-communicable diseases.
And in your paper, you say farmers are losing production in Poland for lack of pollinators. Can they do something about that? Can they import or breed more essential bugs like bees and moths?
Luckily, the solutions to lost pollinators are relatively well established. There are some things we can't change on a farmer level, like climate change, but there are other ways that an individual farmer or a conservation district or a state could introduce policies that would benefit pollinators. So these are things like setting aside parts of your farm so that pollinators have a place to live that are close to your crops. And this could be just a relatively small part of your farm where just bees are able to nest or other insects are able to nest and live. Especially in developed countries, where areas where there are large monoculture fields, where there's kind of a big field growing one thing, and that field just all blooms at once and then kind of goes away at once. The bees have an ability to eat then, but the rest of the year they don't have very much to eat if there aren't other flowering plants nearby. So if farmers are able to plant a diversity of flowering plants, either kind of on the edges of the fields or interspersed among the crops, then it would give pollinators more to eat, and so they would have just a better nutritional status. And then limiting the use of these harmful pesticides like neonicotinoids that are a little too good at killing pests, because they kill a lot of harmful pests, but they also kill the beneficial insects that crops need as well. So this suite of interventions, so habitat, better nutrition, and removing pesticides, all have big effects on supporting pollinators, and luckily they can be done at a range of scales, from the farmer all the way up to a country, or in the case of the EU, which banned neonicotinoids, you know, you can do it even larger.
You would think farmers, especially long-time farmers, would be aware of these losses. Is there farm-based activism calling for more pollinator protection?
That's a good question. I actually don't know of any farmer-based action where they've intervened.
Now, one interesting thing about your study is that it has something to say, I think, to the environmental movement, because you're moving beyond just ecological systems into the broader impacts like human health and the economy, and that's something really valuable in this study.
That's part of the goal of the study, and part of the goal of the field that we're a part of, which is to connect some of these large environmental changes not only to environmental outcomes, which are of course important, but also to other consequences that might strike a chord with people that might be making decisions. So if you're a person making a decision on whether you should ban pesticides in your state, and you realize it's not only an issue of biodiversity and harming pollinators, but maybe it's an issue of the local economy, or if it's an issue of public health, as people aren't able to eat the foods that are keeping them healthy, then it broadens the lens of the potential harms that are being inflicted by some of these big forces, and it really hits home as it hits your pocketbook or, you know, hits your doctor visit, I guess, you know, as you just have more ways that you can now understand that this change affects you personally or affects the people that your neighbors or your other people in your city.
I think the public has the idea that maybe if we had a lot fewer insects, that could be a good thing. I mean, let's get rid of the mosquitoes and the black flies. And I thought about getting rid of black flies. I lived in a rural area in northern Ontario. They were terrible. But then I found out the black flies help pollinate blueberries, and we all love blueberries. So the flies and the bugs that we think we don't like play an important role that we're not really aware of.
Yeah, you often only understand once you begin to kind of tug at one piece of biodiversity that all these other things are connected to it. And so it's very difficult to remove just the pesky parts and keep the parts you like. And sometimes what you think are pesky parts are actually benefiting you. So I guess tinker with nature at your peril.
Matthew Smith, what is next in your own research?
Well, right now, the biggest thing that I am working on is looking at this project in Nepal. So this previous project was great because it looked at the whole world and it kind of gave you this global picture of how pollinator loss is affecting people's health on this big scale. And this project that I'm working on now looks at a very small scale at this individual little spot in Nepal called Jumla, where people are very remote. It's very far from big cities. And we are trying to understand the importance of pollinators to the local food system, how much of what they eat is directly attributable to pollination. And so I'm just a small part in this big study, but they've collected a lot of data on the pollinators, on all the different types of insects that visit the apples and the beans and the pumpkins that grow there, and try to understand how much are those crops dependent on those pollinators, if those pollinators either declined or through interventions, if they came back, how much would nutrition change and how much would that affect health? So this is a very kind of applied study that looks very specifically at this problem at a very small scale. But it's very satisfying because I can actually see the outcomes or understand the people that might be affected as opposed to looking at these kind of global scale models. So it's exciting.
From the Harvard Chan School of Public Health, we've been speaking with research scientist Matthew R. Smith. The open access paper is called Pollinator Deficits, Food Consumption, and Consequences for Human Health, a Modeling Study. Find this and more to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Matthew, thank you for your insight into the creatures that help feed us all.
Thanks, Alex.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Not reported in North America or Europe, Argentina has been roasting in climate-changed heat. It is summer there. After the warmest November to January since 1961, 27 cities broke absolute temperature records in mid-February, the eighth consecutive heat wave in a row. It was 38.1 degrees C, just over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, in the capital, Buenos Aires, the highest in four decades. Nighttime temperatures there only went to 28.5 C, or 83 Fahrenheit, and those are deadly nights when people don't get a chance to cool off. But Argentina and surrounding countries in Central South America have been in a terrible drought since 2019. According to New Science, with the last 4 months of 2022 receiving only 44% of the average precipitation, the lowest rainfall in 35 years. Wheat and soybean crops are suffering, with low yields expected. That further drains the Argentine economy, now wrestling with inflation and close to financial collapse. Uruguay has declared an agricultural emergency. The heat from global warming is hurting crops, but drought is wrecking them. But is this long dry spell caused by climate change? Find out next week as we interview the lead author of the New Science, Paola Arias. Heat stress in South America or China changes the economy and a culture around the world. Think globally. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock and caring about our world.